Blog Talk Radio.
Now, in its second edition, Carol Dean's popular book, The Art of Film Funding, has 12 new chapters to cover all areas of film financing and how to avoid expensive pitfalls. Learn how to start with an idea and end with a trailer. How to make an ask for money. Create your story structure and your trailer. Legal advice. Fair use. Successful crowdfunding. How to ask for music rights. And what insurance you can't shoot without. Available on Amazon under Carol Dean and at FromTheHeartProductions.com. Hi, and welcome to The Art of Film Funding. I'm your co-host, Claire Papin, along with Carol Dean, author of the best-selling book, The Art of Film Funding. Carol is also the founder and president of From the Heart Productions and the host of this show. If Greg Centineo had a title, it could be catalyst for life change, project promoter, or seeker of meaning. His career is indefinable, but a series of seemingly unrelated experiences brought him to where he is today, aiming to increase people's wealth by raising capital for one of Hollywood's most exciting and monumental projects, The Legends of Oz, 3D animated film franchise. Greg was recently a panelist at Winston Baker Film Finance Forum in Los Angeles, where he spoke about his work in the film financing industry. And Greg, we just want to thank you for joining us today. Carol and I have been reading about your film.
Yes,
well,
it's
well, thank
really...
you.
Yeah, you seem to be breaking all the rules in Hollywood, and most of the independent world is watching you because we really want to know more about you and where you came from.
Well, that's I want to find out where I came from as well, so we're all in the same boat. How about that?
Well, you said in some of the wonderful things I read about you that I was raised by a phenomenal dad. He really understood leveraging money and how to make money work for you. So let's start here and tell us about your family.
Yeah, well, thanks. Yeah, I had a really great family, a really good upbringing in Brooklyn. My mom and dad, Joseph and Louise Centineo, Italian background. So I was almost a non-traditional Italian background in Brooklyn. But really, my parents just believed in letting you become who you were designed to be in life. And that was a really great start. You can't ask for anything better than that than to grow up in the way you should actually be design yourself to be. My dad had some very unique concepts, you know, and he understood the power of leverage, and he taught us those things as children, young boys and girls growing up. He taught us the value of money. He taught us the art of not just saving money but investing money, and more importantly, you know, how to make money work for you rather than you just work for it. And he did that not so much with words but by putting us into unique situations where we actually learned those lessons. And it actually took probably up until I was 25, 26 years old to then really begin to understand what he was teaching us. So I think that played a lot into the success of my life and which ultimately had success in the projects I worked on.
Well, boy, that's where it all starts from. It's your family and the home training. And I have to tell you that when I started a business in New York back in the 70s, and I had, when I first landed in New York, I had just started a business in LA, went to New York. I had two friends in New York. One was Italian and one was Jewish, and that's all I needed. And I built a wonderful office and ran it for 30-some-odd years. And it was mainly, I'll tell you, due to the support of the Italian community and the film industry. They were wonderful to me.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Yeah, it sums up New York. It really does. I was in the same circles.
Same circles, yeah. Well, they really worked hard in the film industry in those days, and it was a lot of fun. So I'd like to know why the producers asked you to raise the funds for The Legends of Oz, the franchise.
Well, you know, that's a really – it's a great question. We almost, in a way, we stumbled upon each other. You know, I wasn't in the film industry. I wasn't really out in California. But it was one of those serendipitous moments, you know, in life where you kind of crash into somebody in one way or another. There was a mutual friend that the producer had, obviously I had, and kind of brought us together in early dialogues back in 2007. And, I think there was some unique aspects about me and what I had done in the past. And characteristically, I think there were things that these producers thought I might be able to really help them achieve this amazing vision and dream as an independent production company. So it was kind of serendipitous.
Well, tell us something about the scope of what was raised for the film and how long it took. Please.
You know, as you go back, you know, in time, you know, you look in the early days of the project, you know, we started with a very modest budget for doing an animation project. We looked at about $20 million back in the early days, and but always had a very big scope of what we wanted to ultimately do with this project if we were able to bring in the capital, to execute the vision for the overall business plan, which was an animation franchise, you know, a 3D film, a theatrical release worldwide, licensing, music, etc. So, but we started out very small in those days with a $20 million budget that got us going. And today, when it's all said and done now and all wrapped up and ready for theaters worldwide, we're way north of $110 million.
Wow. Now, because you say this is an animation franchise, could you elaborate on that for us, what it entails?
Yeah, it's the reason I actually got involved in the project. You know, I mean no insult to anybody in the industry of Hollywood, but, I was not really interested in filmmaking, especially from the side of capital, because, everything I heard of, nobody really made money from the investor side of film investing. So I really had a very, very little interest. As a matter of fact, the earlier dialogues with the producers were very comical because I just had no interest in even discussing it with them. But when they used the term franchise, and that was really an important word because that created what I then understood in the principles that my dad taught me. It was the ability to make money with money, make it work for you. And animation is a very unique industry because it really goes beyond the movie, and it goes into other ancillaries. In our case, we're based in four major industries, all independent of the other. You know, we're in the transmedia industry, which is the mobile applications, the virtual worlds, the digital games. We're in the music industry because we're an animated musical, so we have our own soundtrack. And then, of course, licensing industry, the ability to take all of the IP copyrights, intellectual properties that we own, the characters, and be able to license those IPs out to major companies worldwide that create, from all types of categories of dolls, toys, games, foods, even our own theme park ride, what we have now, that's going to be out in 2015. And that's ancillary. So really it becomes more about everything else and really less about the movie. The film is what we call a major part of promoting everything else that you're going to be selling, hopefully for the next few decades. So that's what we mean by franchising. And so when I looked at that model, I thought, wow, this is actually way beyond a movie. I thought, it's really not about a movie. It's about building a business, a really very broad, very deep type of business that's rooted in multi-industry with, in our case, thousands of other revenue streams, and literally thousands of other revenue streams beside the box office and a DVD Blu-ray. So that really, really got my attention back in the early days, and I thought, man, if we can pull this off, as an independent, and stay in full control and autonomy of this project, not lose it to a studio or a distribution company. I thought this can be very, very financially beneficial to not only us from a producer level, but from partner or invest a partner's level as well.
It sounds magnificent. It, yes, when you talk about it, I can see that the film becomes the springboard for all the other areas that you're talking about, all the other sides to it. Well, tell me, when you put the funding package together, were you of the mind of all of these different areas that were financially viable? So did it entail all this in the beginning, or did you just keep adding it? Tell us about that package.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think this is all very good for the listeners. You know, the reason I said yes to the project was because I thought it was a very fair business structure and a business model for investors. That's the first element. You know, if it's not a good deal for an investor, then don't do it. You know, it's a simple premise in life. I mean, it's the line I've walked my whole life. You try to do good in the world that we live in. We all have to make money, but you want it to be fair. And I think that's what caught my attention early on, was that the model was extremely fair. And, you know, we decided early on, the production company, independent production company, decided very early on that they would be willing to share ownership with the partners, the investors that would come into the project. And that would mean ownership of the intellectual properties. That ownership, literally, you become a ground level owner of what you're building here. So if it works, or as I used to say, if it generates any revenue, you're gonna get paid. You're in a position to get paid. You had a first position payback. We kind of really broke the mold and literally put the production company into a last position, you know, and the investors into a first position, which is unheard of.
Yes.
So the model was very, you know, and that's why I actually said yes, because I thought this is a really, really fair business model. But I didn't think it was going to happen, to be quite honest with you, ladies, because, you know, we call it the impossible dream to have done what we've done. So looking at it early on, I knew, though, well, if we did succeed, you know, at least it would be a very fair deal for everybody involved, investors and production company. And if it worked, we know our investors would get paid and could get paid for years to come, because animation doesn't stop with your movie. It's actually, like you said, it's the start point. So we did. We put a unique model together, put the investors into a first position behind, in front of the production company, and we offered full ownership, 50-50 ownership between the production company and the partners of all rights, copyrights, intellectual properties. That means, like I said, anything and everything that would ever sell in this franchise worldwide, our investors would be a part of that financial waterfall.
That's brilliant. Well, of course, that would be very enticing. The thing is that what you're talking about is the rights to the books. How many of Baum's books on Oz, how many books did you get the rights to?
We bought 10 of the Roger Baum collection. Roger now has 16. And as you know, he's the great-grandson of the author of The Wizard of Oz. And he's been writing his own, you know, children's Wizard of Oz sequels since 1987. He wrote Dorothy of Oz, which is a bestseller. We went out and we purchased the first 10 books of his series. We also have first right on anything else that he's putting together as we continue to build the franchise. So we have a pretty broad scope of where we want to take the franchise. The movie is going to be one of three films that we're going to be releasing over the next 6 to 7 years, as well as an ongoing television series. And hopefully, we hope down the road this can actually be picked up as a live stage play as well. So, you know, there's really unlimited dreaming for what we have here.
Sounds like a lifetime job for you. There's just so much that can be done with it, right?
Yeah, there is. It keeps going. You know, it does. I think there's no limits to what we can do with it. Ironically enough, as you said that, from you said lifetime job for me, you know, leading what I led, my element of the project, you know, I'm not an animator, I'm not a story writer, I'm not a real producer, you know, I had something to do with that, those elements along the way. You know, I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a businessman. You know, my role is basically done for this project. I did what I had to do, which was the impossible, if you would, and help to make sure that we were able to provide the funds needed to execute, to get it where it is today. And, you know, on May 9th of 14, just less than 2 months, we launch this film wide release. So my job is really done. How, you know, and how I, you know, it's on the track, it's a train, now it moves, and so I don't know what my role would be moving forward.
I see. Well, let me say that I read that you are quoted as saying that something that we seldom hear in the film financing world, that you don't do anything that you don't believe in, and you don't do anything that you don't put your own money into. So from that, I would say your investors would really love you.
Yeah, they do. I love them. You know, it is. It's a great little community of people that have really grown together and have applied a simple principle of belief and action, and to have accomplished what we've all accomplished. It really has. It's taken a great group of people from the production side, from the financial side, to accomplish what we have. And I do. Anything that I do in this world, the sum of life really boils down to what gets you out of bed in the morning. And, you know, you have to love what you're doing. My dad taught us that growing up. My father said to us many years ago as children, he said, specifically to me, he said, Gregory, he said, if you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life. And he was correct. You know, a lot of times people say, when are you going to take a break? And I look at him, take a break from what? You know, I love what I do, and I don't do anything unless I love doing it. And I'm 50 years old now, and I've had the decision to make throughout the decades of, if I wake up in the morning and don't like the way my life is feeling, I'm going to change it, because no one's going to change it for me. So if I want to make sure I'm doing what I believe in and what I love, and you know what, you find more success in that pattern than you're doing anything else in the world. So, and I have to put my money into it. That's the key. How can you ask anybody to believe in what you're doing if your own belief doesn't have your own money behind it? I mean, you know, I'll quote Jesus. Jesus said 2,000 years ago, he said, where your treasure is, so is your heart. So how can you say your heart is in something but your money's in your bank account? I mean, it doesn't, in the term that I've come to be, have grown to become disgusted with over the last 8 years of doing this, is how people sometimes say use other people's money, you know, and that's a horrible philosophy in my world, because you put everybody else in the rowboat and you stay on the shore, and if something goes wrong, you're safe, and that's just not a good philosophy. So for me to have done this, you know, I'm a seven-time investor in this project. My kids, 17 and 19, are investors. My siblings, my cousins, friends of 30, 40 years are in this project. I mean, you know, in-laws, you name it. I mean, you know, it starts with your, you know, in your own circle. And if you, and people, you know, they are attracted to passion and belief. And so, you know, that's how I function. And I think that's probably the reason for this success, was that all of us at the higher levels in this franchise believed in what we were trying to achieve. And you know, it's not so much, you know, belief isn't a blind aspect. You know, it doesn't just say you're going to succeed. Because in the early days, from 2006 to 2008, you know, we were very frank with everybody. We believed in what we were doing, but we told everybody we're probably going to fail. I mean, so people think belief means just ignoring the obvious. No, it's literally being in tune with reality. And reality was in 07, 08, this ain't going to happen. This is an improbability, and you got to be honest about that. But I'm not going to stop trying. That's where belief comes in. I'm not going to stop trying. Then over the course of time, as you start to mitigate the risk levels, as you execute, you start to put this project together, or any project, and you start to realize, you know what, we're going to do this. And so it's an evolution of time, but it never delineates the reality of this ain't going to happen. You know, it's funny, the earlier days, Carol, I used to tell friends and family, they said, we want to put money into this project. We believe in you. We believe in the things you do, and we're going to put a bet on you. I said, that's great. I said, I think it's a great opportunity. I said, but I'm going to tell you right now, you're going to lose every dime you put into this project. And they look at me and go, what? I go, you're going to lose every single penny in this great opportunity. And it was kind of a paradox, but it's the truth. I love paradoxes. It was the absolute truth. And they would look at me and go, well, if I'm going to lose my money, then why should I put it into the project? And I would always say, just in case we pull it off. And that's the reality of life. People think, well, they think they want a guarantee. There are no guarantees. What you're betting on is that we have enough belief, enough luck, enough prayer, enough everything that you can say that this will come together. And if it does, then the opportunity comes to fruition. But everything starts in the same place. They're Hail Marys. So I think for us and the people around us, we were very frank and very honest in the first, 3 to 4 years. And we said, this is a great opportunity. And obviously today now we've done it. It's an amazing it's an amazing project, amazing franchise, and those that are involved are thrilled to have been involved. But it started with what we call clarity of understanding that this would probably not happen, but they still did it. That's a lesson for the world.
Exactly.
Yes, it is. It is. You know, we have a caller, and if you guys are ready to take a question, shall I go ahead and invite them on?
Sure.
Is that okay, Greg?
Okay. Hello, caller. You are live here on The Art of Film Funding with Carol and Greg. Did you have a question for us? Caller, are you there? Okay, so perhaps they may have already gone. We do have one more that has joined us, and I just want to bring them on as well. Hello, are you still with us? Nope, it looks like they have also. Just feel free to call back in. You're probably still listening, so feel free to call back in. Carol and Greg, you want to continue?
Sure. Greg, there's so many wonderful things that you've said that I want to expand on. You mentioned a theme park ride in 2015. Couldn't you tell us which theme park it would be in?
No, but the great company, Attraction Media and Entertainment, which licensed that out from us back in early late 2011, I don't have any information on which park. It can be any park domestically or globally. So we're pretty excited. They haven't released the information on where it's going to be at this point. But
you sold that,
nice,
and they go sell it to the parks. How interesting. So you don't have to do the work. You just make one deal and let them see how many places they can install it for you.
Exactly. Licensing in the industry of animation is a phenomenal place to be in what you own. Again, we remember this. We own the rights to what we've created. So we own our stories. We own our animation characters. The likeness of our all of our animation characters, and companies will look at what you have and realize this is for children and it's going to be on theater screens, and we'll look at that and want to license the rights from you. And the great part about that is it's like you know what, here's a comparison, Carol. I always say you can write two concepts down: real estate property, intellectual property.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best way to understand what is an intellectual property. Well, compare it to real estate property. Real estate is brick and mortar. You know, if you buy a 40-unit apartment building, you can go ahead, you own the building, and then 40 units are leased out. You lease out what you own. You break it into 40 parts, and you can multiply that by 40 different rentals every single month. That's how you make money. And you also make money when the property goes up in value. We own intellectual property, which means we've created something. It's not brick and mortar. You really can't touch it. It's intellectual. But companies can use those characters. So we can lease out not 40 units, but unlimited IP licensing deals, because there's no limits on what we can do. We're not bound to brick and mortar. And so the beauty about what we were creating was we knew if it had any success at all, in other words, if children liked it to any remote way, shape, or form, companies could be interested in renting our characters and putting them on dolls, toys, games, rides, you name it. And the list goes on and on and on. Not only in the area of what we call, you know, toys and what tangible goods, but also intangible goods like digital goods, you know, from our virtual world, which now we take our movie characters and they're digital on computer screens and smartphones and iPads. And, you know, we're able to license out those characters to companies like Blocks World, which just, you know, takes what we license to them. And we make money every time kids or adults make purchases on those digital game sites. So it really is a world of, I call it the new world. It's, you know, I don't invest in real estate anymore. I invest in intellectual property. It's the new world that we live in, the ability to take what you own and create it into multiple properties that can be licensed out worldwide. And there's no limits to how many licensing deals you can put together. I don't know if you realize the Cars franchise, done by Pixar back in 2006, that first movie that Cars, that Disney and Pixar put out, I think it did $244 million in its domestic box office. And it had no history, you know, it had no books. It just came out of the blue in 06, and they launched it, and it was a huge success. Do you realize it did $10 billion in global retail sales in the first 5 years after the first film? $10 billion. It did $2 billion a year in global retail sales.
Incredible.
That right. And the box office domestically was only $244 million. It did less than $500 million worldwide. But it did $10 billion in global retail sales in its first 5 years. And then the second film came out. And there was a great article in the Huff Post back in 2012 about that, and it said, you know, sandwiched in between the two releases, with the two film releases, was $10 billion in global retail sales. And after that second movie, the Huff Post business section said that brand, that franchise for Disney, will do $2 billion a year in global retail sales forever because of those two films. So, you know, and because one success can generate thousands of other revenue streams, you know, within a year. So the industry of animation is really quite remarkable, and that's why we say you can even have a failed film and still do very well in the animation industry.
Yeah, I can understand that now. You've explained that so clearly for us. Thank you. Because your background in franchises made you understand and see all these ramifications much better than the normal Hollywood executive producer who would go out and raise funds for the film. You were able to see the intellectual property situation, which is probably easier for you to make these sales than a normal executive producer in Hollywood. Would you agree?
Yeah, you know what? That's really well put. It's true. What I brought to the table, to the independent production company, which is Summertime Entertainment, I brought an outside, you know, perspective. You know, I when I got to the table with these guys, I studied. No, I did, and I'm a researcher. You know, success. You know, not just successful. You know, people just look at what I do and they think, oh my gosh, you're so lucky. I work very hard. So when I got into this in 07. I spent the first 7 months researching your industry, the animation industry, independent filmmaking, and you know my analysis was not positive. It was like this is a disaster. It's very difficult to be successful in this industry, especially as an independent. And so I brought to the table basically an outside perspective. I said, number one, you know, we can't keep doing what everybody independently keeps doing because it ain't working. You know, put it this way, there's not a high enough rate of success to be doing what everybody's doing. It's all calculated risk. And I look at that and I go, I ain't doing it if we're going to do it like everybody else because it ain't working. you know, for the most part. So let's change it. And I think that's a message, you know, for the world and for the not just this industry, any industry, is you got to be willing to pioneer. You know, what do you want to do? Then just start there, and it might take you off the track and down a completely different path. So, you know, one, I said, you know, we're not going to sell foreign. We're not going to do any pre-sales overseas. Well, everybody does pre-sales. Right, and that's why you lose the value of your film overseas, because you sold it way early. Why did you do that? You know, well, because we have to. We can't. We need money for the budget. Well, let's come up with a different way of getting money for the budget rather than selling pre-sales. It's dumb. It's like giving up the farm before you have a farm. Why would you do that? You know, if we're going to work hard, let's maintain full control and autonomy of this stuff. So, you know, the other thing was, even domestically, we're not going to sign a distribution deal until we have a finished product, because you have a much better negotiating position with a finished film than you do with a non-finished film. So why sell? Because we need a budget. We need to come up with a different way of getting the money for the budget than giving up the entire project to these big institutions. That's what ends up happening. We give it away. And I understand producers, because producers are artists, and they just want to get their art made. So they do. They sell off the rights to it to get the money to really work for the people now who own the rights to their art. And it's got to change. So I said, I ain't doing it that way. There's no way. I said, if I get involved in this, I said, if the goal is not just to finish this, but it's to finish it with all the control and all of the autonomy. That's the goal. And that's what we did. And so I brought that perspective to the table, and I understood the power of what we had. But it takes money. And that's, listen, that you not when people say, well, money is everything. And I don't mean that it should be everything in your world, but you can't do anything. Very little. You can breathe without money. And even water today costs a dollar now. So, you know, there's not very much you can do in this world without money. So let's just be very honest with it. It takes money to accomplish things, whether they're small, medium, or large. It takes money. And so you have to understand that. But how you bring it in and who you allow to come in is also a big part of it. You know, I wasn't interested in dealing with studios, because I know the ethos of the studio. It's not to make us wealthy. It's to make themselves wealthy. So you jump in the boat with them, guess what? You're going to be in the bottom of the boat.
Right.
Why do it? Calculate a different path to accomplish what you want to accomplish. And that's what I did, Carol, when I came in. I came in with a completely different perspective, and I wasn't willing. And I told them that. I said, if you ask me to jump in your boat, I ain't doing it, because that boat don't sail. Not often enough. So I ain't jumping in that boat. Yeah, but if you're willing to rethink this and figure it out, you know, last week's film finance forum that I was speaking at, you know, I told, you know, everyone in that auditorium is looking to me, you know, for how to do this, how to do with that. And I said, look, I'm not going to give you a how-to-do list. I'm not going to write a book so I can make a few million dollars and you buy it because you want to know how, and you're not going to be able to do what I did. And the reason is because you got to do what you got to do, meaning this. I had to get out of bed every single day, guys, and figure it out. I didn't read books. I had to get out of bed and figure this out every day. There wasn't a how-to-do book or journal or manual for me to read, and I knew what we were doing was unique because it was us doing it. It was our idea. It was our project, which made it unique. Therefore, you got to figure out how to do it. So every day that I got out of bed, I had to figure out a way to do what we now have done every single day. And that's effort, and that's work, and that's ambiguity, waking up every day and not knowing how. But that's what makes it. That's what makes the journey the journey. You know, now that the project is done, I'm the only one that's sad, because we've done it. I'm finished. I'm the journey. I rode this ambiguous wave for 7 years of my life. And everybody's now thrilled because on May 9th it hits box office worldwide. I'm depressed. You know, because it was such a great ride. And I love the journey. I love getting up and not knowing how to do this. I love getting up and having most of the people you talk to every day not believe in what you're doing. How about that?
Well,
You know,
that's yes. pretty good, Greg.
Exactly right.
Greg, would you like to take some of the callers? I believe there's a couple of people who have called back for us. I'll go ahead and introduce one now. I'm going to go to area code 732. Hello, caller. Are you with us?
I am.
I'm not sure what's going on. Are you there?
Can you hear me?
Okay. Well, it could be that, yes.
Yeah, we can
caller,
hear you. Go
you?
Right ahead. You have a question?
I do. You know, it seems pretty incredible to raise that kind of money. If you could put one reason why people would give you money, what reason would you use?
That's a great question. I don't think it's really one reason, to be honest with you, but I will give you one reason. If I boil it down to one reason of why people invest in anything, it's hope. That's the reason. It's hope. You know, we live in a world. Everybody wakes up every day to try to become successful, to try to have a little bit more money in their accounts than they did yesterday, to try to make a better life for themselves and their family. And so we really walk the earth looking for things of hope. And so I think that's the primary reason. And I think, you know, not, you know, if you present something to somebody, we're going to make a great animation film for children, they're going to really love it. That's really great. But that's not fulfilling the number one thing that people want, which is hope. That if what I am going to put money into can somehow change my world financially. That's in some way, shape, or form. So great question, and I would say it's hope. So, and you know what, and I got to tell you, the time frame, Claire and Carol, for this project, to elaborate on the caller's question, really was a time of hopelessness in the world. We're talking 07, 08, 09, I mean, I'm sure that rings a bell for everybody, the heart yeah. of the worldwide recession. You know, the global implosion, economic implosion, our country, you know, the real estate implosion, the institutional Merrill Lynch's and Bear Stearns letting the public down, the bankruptcies of banks. You know, this was a very difficult time. People losing jobs, losing 401ks to this implosion. You couldn't talk about a worse time of hope. And I was told, by the way, countless times, and they probably were correct. They said, you know, you're picking the worst time in economic history to do this. And they were right, but they were wrong, because it really was a time when we emerged as a company. We emerged, we had something called hope. And all the traditional investments at that time were burning, all on fire. And so people looked to what we were doing and realized, my gosh, if these guys can be successful, and then it became, if we can be successful, this can change my situation. I've had investors tell me in 2011, they said, you know, I don't care if we never make any money at this point, because it carried this, just being in this gave me hope in 07, 09, when I had nothing else to look forward to. You know, financially in my world, my business was collapsing. They said it got me out of bed in the morning because I had hope. And so, you know, we did this during the worst global recession in history. And I think that the answer is a great question, what I call it, because I think the primary answer is it offered hope to people.
Well, I'd like to add that the most important thing about the whole pitch and the everything is your faith in what you're doing. You believe in this. You've convinced me it's a good investment, and I'm sure everyone listening feels, my gosh, I'm sorry I missed this opportunity, because you believe in it, and you were the connector, the man carrying the film project, and all of this intellectual property and the knowledge of what could be done with it. So, of course, they believed in you. I'm sorry, but to me, it's your faith in the project that you were able to share with them. So I'm sure they were a great, that they were hoping that they would benefit from it because you loved it so much. So that's, to me, the secret. It's the man pitching the project. Does he believe it? Has he invested in it? This is seldom true in Hollywood. But you've invested, your family, your friends. Those things say a lot for who you are, Greg.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. It's a whole new ball game here.
I agree.
Yeah,
it
you
is.
Have so many.
You make a great point. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, and of course we do have another caller who would like to ask a question, and so we'll invite them in now. And so this is another caller. Oh, well, it looks like that line has already dropped. Let me go ahead and go to the next person here. So area code 908, caller, you're on with Greg. Please ask your question. Caller, you are on with Greg. Are you still with us? Area code 954.
I'm here. Can you guys hear me?
Looks like that line has already
We got him. Go ahead.
Do
you have
well?
A question?
Yes, ask your question.
We
stand by. I believe they've hooked back in with us. Okay. Are you back in with us? Area code 732 now. Caller with area code 732, are you with us? There may be a delay in their answering us. It looks like the lines are not holding in with the system this morning. Could be a little bit of a glitch in the system. Area code 954, are you with us?
Yes, I am here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we
yeah.
can.
We
go
can.
Ahead.
Please go ahead with your question.
Oh, fantastic. Well, it's been such an enlightening hour with you guys, and Greg, thank you for sharing. You know, I'm a big fan of Oz myself, and there's a theme that's kind of close to the heart of Oz, and it's called defying gravity. And it appears from what you're saying and what you're sharing with us this morning, that's what you have done. You have literally defied gravity in a situation, and as you say, pulling off the impossible. But how does it feel personally? I know you said you feel a little depressed now that your part of the job is over, but knowing the impact that you're going to have on so many people's lives, can you maybe share a little bit about what it feels like to be, you know, personally, what it feels like to defy gravity?
Yeah, man, that's a great, I love the phrase defying gravity from the book Wicked by Greg McGuire. I think, you know, there's no better feeling. Walt Disney said many years ago, he said, it's fun to do the impossible. And he wasn't kidding. You'll have the time of your life when you defy gravity. You know, for me, there's a lot of mixed emotions to this. You know, C.S. Lewis once said, to the level by which you will love will also be to the level by which you will hurt. So if you love hard, you're going to hurt hard one day as well. And so, you know, defying gravity, creating something like this with a great group of people has been one of the greatest experiences of my life. You breathe it every single day. It's in your blood. I mean, there wasn't a day that went by in 7 years that this wasn't on my mind. I mean, it becomes your life. It really does. You have a relationship with the project. You have an intimate relationship with it. You know, I won't take it to bed or anything like that. Well, I will say once. No, anyway, you won't take it to bed, but you have an intimate relationship with this experience, and when you do wake up, and you've done it, and I've known it, and you know it's coming. You know, one day it's going to end. You're going to be finished, and when it happens, it's abrupt. It's, you know, what you've done for 7 years and what's made, and I won't say define your life. It certainly doesn't define your life. You literally define the project. But what has been such an intimate part of your life is now finished. It's like a breakup, or better yet, it's like sending your child to college. And it's riveting, and it was riveting for me this week as I dealt with that. On the flip side, I haven't had a chance to celebrate, you know, the accomplishment. I haven't had a chance to really take in now the magnitude of what we've done and the people that have come into this amazing franchise and the potential life change that we're going to see happen over the next decade or so. You know, those are going to be things that I think I'll begin to enjoy, but it's really hard. You know, you really, I mean, my engine, you know, the RPMs are running at, you know, 6,000, you know, every day. And then to now say, all right, listen, you can bring it down now. You can idle the car. It's like, what? You know, so it's really is. And that's the beauty of it. And I think I was telling a friend the other day, I wouldn't exchange the pain, you know, the pain that I've had, you know, of realizing it's over and you know, your life changes now. That's part of the spectrum of emotions that you have to experience in anything in this world. So it was good to kind of go through that the other day and realize how much I really loved what I was doing, because I'm hurting so much right now that I'm not doing it anymore. And so someone says, well, it's going to, you know, better things coming. And I go, that doesn't work that way. I'm not look better. It's like being married for 7 years and unfortunately your wife passes away. You say, let's head out to the bar tonight. There's better women out there. And it's moving. No, you don't move on. That's not what it's about. It's about, you know, literally lamenting and mourning this beauty that you've experienced for so many years. And you can say this is an animation film. It's an animation franchise. It's the film industry. And I'm talking about this beautiful relationship with something, because the project becomes you. You and the people that are involved. It's not what you're doing. It's who you're doing it with. And I think that's such an important principle. And that's how I've lived my life. It's not, you know, you almost do these things because you need an excuse to be with people. You know, when you do something like this or any business concept, you know, there's always money involved. So people give their time and attention, which creates community. You know, it's really funny. So there's this huge benefit that comes along with living, I would say, a passion-driven life. And so I appreciate the caller's perspective. He's right. You know, I think now the fun part begins, and I certainly will engage in that. And believe me, I will. I like to have fun, and I will. And we'll kind of really hopefully walk into a very, very, very profitable situation in years to come.
Well, I'm sure you will, but let me just say that I seldom hear people say they enjoyed the journey. What happens to filmmakers is they get so involved and are under so much pressure during the journey that all they think of is the destination. You know, when the film is finished, that's the view and that's what they're living for. And you lived the day-to-day existence and enjoyed the journey. So how did you keep on that track? Because of all the emotions, it's a roller coaster ride. So tell us how we can do that.
Well, it's not, you know, it's got to be a lifestyle. And I think, you know, we're not really talking about the film industry anymore. Now we're talking about what really makes life life. And, you know, I've just made decisions many years ago that I'm not going to do anything I don't believe in. I'm not going to do anything I don't enjoy doing. And that's a lifestyle. And, you know, sometimes I've paid the price for that. And most of the time I've won in doing that. And, you know, I was 16 years old. Just to give you an idea, it's a decision you make of how you're going to live your life. I was 16 working in Food Town in Brooklyn, which was a grocery store. And I was in the produce. I was working the produce section. And I hated it. Every day I go to work, I hated it. And then the words of my father would echo every night when I'd walk out of that produce section and clock out and walk home. I'd hear my dad's words that, if you do what you love, you'll never work a day in your life. And I realized, I don't love this, and this is, I'm working every time I come in here. And I quit. And I want to tell you something, Claire, Carol, that was the last job I ever had in my life, was Food Town in Brooklyn when I was 16. And I never did anything again unless I loved it. And that's not. And listen, that doesn't mean it's going to be a walk in the park, because, you know, someone said to me the other day at the Film Finance Forum, they said, "Greg, what's your greatest fear? What do you fear the most?" And I said, "The only thing I about the project or about the process," I said, "was nothing. I mean, there were nights you wake up. Trust me, in this project, there are nights that you wake up sweating in areas that you don't even have pores to be sweating in. That's, you know, but what I always fear, the one fear that I have that stays with me all the time, is the fear that I won't find something else to do that has meaning. That's when I, because those things don't always come by. It's hard to find things that you're going to love to do and that bring great meaning to your life. But you've got to make decisions that you don't compromise that. So that's what I do fear. It's not easy. Believe me, it's just not, you know, it just doesn't happen. You have to, it's a lifestyle decision you make, and that's how I do it.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. Well, we only have a few minutes left, and I got to get into the distribution, because what you've told us about film financing, so unique and out of the box, that can you just share with us some of the information on your non-traditional distribution?
Yeah, I mean, it's. I would say it's traditional because we have a distribution company, which is Clarius Entertainment, and led by Bill Sadler and Mike Patey and Claire Heath, Louise Chatter, great group of people, Andrew Williams. It's a fairly new company. That's obviously, the name is new, but the individuals have, you know, decades of experience. You know, they chose us and we chose them. You know, when you walk this path, it is non-traditional because we didn't take it to a Warner Brothers. We didn't take it to a Paramount. Universal didn't come knocking, banging on our door and say, "We want," you know, we were in a situation where we wanted to maintain the control and ownership of the film. And then whoever distributed the film, you know, we weren't giving it to you. This is something that we worked on very hard. This is ours. And we want to make sure you're going to handle it with care. And so we felt that Clarius, as they felt that we were, a great project for them and they for us, because, you know, this will be their first major release as a company. And so guess what? They're very pregnant with our project. Guess what? You know, they've got their undivided attention on our project because this is their first. So it was almost a perfect scenario for us. You know, if you go to Universal, they want to take your project for a distribution deal, but you might be one of 40 films, and you know you're going to be very low on their totem pole. And Clarius, with us, with the Clarius situation, is this is very important to them. This is their come out party, if you would. So it helped, and the fact that we waited till we had a finished movie. So we were in a very good position. You weren't guessing if this is going to be good. You knew who it was. It was already casted. It was already done. It was in the can, the movie. So that was a strong position to be in for us. And it was something that we believed back in 07. If we can get the movie done, then sign distribution, we'll be in a much stronger position. Same thing with your overseas markets that have now been sold over the last 6 to 7 months. So, that's where it's unique, and I think, you know, it's a very fair deal with Clarius and us, which is fantastic, and I think it'll be very good for both companies.
Well, will you have the normal windows of distribution? Is it theatrical and then VOD and then downloads, etc.?
Oh yeah, it's being distributed by Clarius. We're coming in. It's a wide release, so we're in over 3,000 theaters on May 9th. Downstreams are done by 20th Century Fox. Hyde Park is doing all of the international distribution, and Sony is distributing the soundtrack worldwide. So this is a global release, wide release. Anywhere screen-wise, we're going to be out on between 44 and 7,500 screens.
Wow. Wonderful. So Clarius has jumped in, and of course, if you've got a very close working relationship and you are the prime film, then you're sitting in the catbird seat, I would say.
Yeah, you know, you are, and that's right. I mean, it's exactly correct, and that's the position you want to be in. You know, listen, you take pride in what you built, and we all have, from the CEO down, and our partners, our investor partners, this is their baby. We own this, and we want it in good hands.
That's so wonderful. Well, tell us where we can learn more about the film and its release.
All right. Well, great. I would definitely, for the listeners, go to legendsofozmovie.com. That's the consumer website, legendsofozmovie.com. And you get a chance to find out all the inside stuff to the project a little bit. The trailer is there. As a matter of fact, the full-length trailer was just released last Friday on Peabody and Sherman. You can go to the Apple, trailers.apple.com and look at the trailer there. You can look at our virtual world, play our virtual world at legendsofozworld.com. That's definitely aspects. Our Facebook page is a great place to go. Look this up, Facebook, which is Legends of Oz, and our Twitter account, Legends of Oz as well. But probably the consumer website is the best place to go right now.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for all your advice and all your knowledge that you've learned and your unique way of looking at our industry. It's the right way to look at it, and I know that you have empowered a lot of filmmakers today with all this information. Claire and I sincerely thank you, Greg, for the show and for joining us and sharing.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate both of you inviting me onto the show today. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, so we'll be looking up your movie, and we'll be at the theater, both of us.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you. All right. Well, everyone have a wonderful day. Thanks again.
Blog Talk Radio.
Now, in its second edition, Carol Dean's popular book, The Art of Film Funding, has 12 new chapters to cover all areas of film financing and how to avoid expensive pitfalls. Learn how to start with an idea and end with a trailer. How to make an ask for money. Create your story structure and your trailer. Legal advice. Fair use. Successful crowdfunding. How to ask for music rights. And what insurance you can't shoot without. Available on Amazon under Carol Dean and at FromTheHeartProductions.com. I want to remind our listeners that David Raiklin is a brilliant and talented award-winning musician who scores films and can compose music for a trio or for a full orchestra. David is a very good friend to the independent filmmaker and comes highly recommended by From the Heart Productions. If you need music to help tell your story, please contact him at davidraiklin.com. That's David, RAIKLEN.com. And Carol and I want to thank you for tuning in to The Art of Film Funding. Please visit our website at FromTheHeartProductions.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good luck with your films, everyone.